Welcome back to Take Care, a weekly conversation on health and wellness, produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And I'm Linda Lowen. Registered nurse Patty Wukovitz spoke about the death of her daughter, Kimberly, from meningitis B. Kimberly was a healthy high school senior. She developed flu-like symptoms, was admitted to the hospital, then the ICU, and died from the disease. Kimberly had been fully vaccinated against meningococcal disease, but at the time there was no vaccine for the B strain of meningitis. Today there is. It became available in 2014, but it is not part of the standard vaccine. A separate shot is necessary to protect against meningitis B.
Patty Wukovitz believes her daughter's death could have been prevented had she received the meningitis B vaccine. So we're delving more deeply into the issue with an overview of meningitis, the disease in general, the standard vaccine, and we'll focus on meningitis B and why the vaccine for that strain isn't as commonly administered. Here to give us the facts on meningitis is one of the leading authorities on the disease. Dr. Alan Tunkel is Associate Dean for Medical Education at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. He's widely acknowledged as an international expert in bacterial meningitis and other central nervous system infections. Welcome to Take Care, Dr. Tunkel. Thanks so much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me.
Before we get into the specifics of the disease, we'd like to know, how typical is Kimberly's situation? She was brought to the ER within 24 hours of symptoms, put on IV antibiotics. Meningitis was identified, but still they were unable to save her life. Is that common?
I would say it's not that common, but definitely can occur, particularly in patients who are infected by the bacteria that's called the meningococcus. There are some patients who just have a rapidly overwhelming form of this disease who can get sick very, very quickly and can have a very bad outcome. Probably about 10 to 15% of patients who develop meningococcal meningitis will die of their disease. And in fact, what Kimberly's mother described in seeing the red dots on her ankles, I think is how she described them, I think is a very worrisome sign. In fact, when I lectured to our medical students at Brown University, I showed them pictures of this type of rash because it's critically important for them to know that if they see that type of rash, there's a high possibility the patient may have meningococcemia and whose condition can progress very, very rapidly.
Let's talk about some of the other symptoms, because the red dots on the ankles, I don't think that's commonly known to the public. Most times when there's a discussion of meningitis, there's always, did the individual have stiffness or soreness in the neck? So if you would cover all the bases on symptoms that would most typically present in the early stages, that would be helpful.
So the most common clinical presentation in people with bacterial meningitis are four main things. Patients can have fever, headache, stiff neck, and altered sensorium, which means they're not thinking clearly or may have an inability to concentrate. Those are the four common things that have been reported, although I would tell you that probably fewer than 50% of patients will have all four of those symptoms, although the majority, usually more than 95%, will generally have at least two of those findings. The rash that I described earlier and that was seen in Kimberly is only seen in about 50% of patients who have meningococcemia. So even the absence of the rash may be present in patients who have meningococcal meningitis. In addition, patients can have nausea and vomiting and may generally feel ill with a lot of muscle aches and joint aches.
Now, you describe this as being the bacterial form. Is the viral form any different in terms of symptoms?
Yeah. People with viral meningitis can also present with fever, headache, and stiff neck. They may also describe something called photophobia, where the light really hurts their eyes. But typically, they do not have altered sensorium. So you can have a conversation with them. They're thinking clearly. They have the ability to concentrate.
Do you think that most people are aware enough to identify this? Because obviously, fever and headache, that's typical signs of common cold or the flu. It would seem that perhaps meningitis is not something that they immediately jump to, and that time element is important, isn't it?
Right, and it's something that needs to be thought of. But you're right, when you think about how many people in their lives have fever and headache, headache that may resolve very quickly with administration of analgesics. But I think in patients who have the fever and are having headache that is unremitting despite administration of appropriate analgesics like acetaminophen, for example, or are developing stiff neck or just don't seem right, those are really the warning signs that much more may be going on.
Now, when we talk about how this spreads, it's a little bit confusing because as we spoke to Kimberly's mom, she said they were all tested for the disease. Her boyfriend, the family members, people that were in close proximity to her, and nobody did get it, and they don't know where she got it.
Yeah, it's hard to know where she may have gotten it. So for the specific one that Kimberly had that's called meningococcus, this can be spread person to person. And someone can acquire a particularly virulent strain, and they may harbor it in the back of their nose. And if there's been any close contact, usually exchange of saliva or secretions is an efficient way of spreading this disease. Or even having close contact, that's usually defined as someone who has had contact within 3 feet of an infected person for a minimum of 8 hours, their risk may be increased. That's why the spread of the disease may be a little bit higher in those who live in the same households, who may be in college dormitories or daycare settings where, again, the spread is more likely to occur.
Are there people who are more vulnerable to getting the disease? I mean, if so many people may carry the bacteria in the back of their throat but never come down with it, what separates them from somebody who does get meningitis?
Yeah, it may be that they're acquiring a particularly virulent strain that's more likely to invade. I can tell you that if you just did swabs in the back of the nose of the general adult population, you would probably find this meningococcus bacterium in about 10% of people. But it's there. It's never going to cause them any problem. So whatever reason, there may be a virulent strain that may be in the community that gets spread from one person to another.
Obviously, the symptoms are one thing, but how is it accurately diagnosed?
Well, so you have to think about the diagnosis first. Obviously, cultures will be taken of the patient's blood. In addition, a test that's used to diagnose meningitis, one of the most important tests, is something called a lumbar puncture, where a small needle is introduced between two of the vertebrae in the lower spine, and some spinal fluid can be withdrawn and analyzed.
So that's like what we know as a spinal tap, the lumbar puncture.
Correct.
But the scary thing is, even if you make the diagnosis, you can't always save the patient.
Right. The unfortunate fact is that sometimes even thinking about the diagnosis as rapidly as possible, instituting appropriate antimicrobial therapy or antibiotics, that some patients may still not have a good outcome. And as I mentioned earlier, for the meningococcus that Kimberly had, about 10 to 15% of patients still succumb to this disease. And even the ones who survive, probably about 10 to 20% of them may have residual neurologic deficits.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Take Care, a conversation on health and wellness produced by WRVO Public Media. I'm Linda Lowen.
And I'm Lorraine Rapp.
And joining us today for a discussion of meningitis is Dr. Alan Tunkel. He's Associate Dean for Medical Education at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University, and he's widely acknowledged as an international expert in bacterial meningitis and other central nervous system infections. Dr. Tunkel, when you mentioned that 10 or 15% will die of the disease, I hate to use the phrase, but is it just luck of the draw, or are there situations or conditions or underlying problems that may result in that unfortunate outcome, or is it not anything so specific, it just happens?
Yeah, I would have to say it just happens. I mean, some patients that may be at increased risk of having a bad outcome is people who've had their spleens removed or have a disease where the spleen may not be functioning. So they already have a diminished immune system that may not help them fight the infection. But the issue with the meningococcus in particular is that it is a bacteria that can affect normal, healthy people and can lead to a bad outcome.
So let's switch gears now and talk about the vaccine. The CDC recommends that adolescents and others at risk receive the standard vaccine that protects against four of the five strains of the disease, but stop short of recommending this meningitis B vaccine that's now available. Why are they allowing it if you ask for it, but they don't recommend it or put it in the main vaccine? Would you just explain that to us?
The two vaccines that are available for meningococcus, so one is the vaccine that you mentioned earlier that covers four of the groups of meningococcus, the ones that are indicated by the letters A, C, W, and Y. That vaccine is what's called a conjugate vaccine. So it's a vaccine that has activity against the outside of the bacteria called the bacterial capsule. And it's been very effective, and it induces an immune response that can give protection to patients who have been vaccinated and may be exposed to that particular bacteria. And that vaccine is given usually at 11 or 12 years of age. And then because some of the immunity wanes with time, it's recommended that patients get a booster dose when they're about 16 years of age. The other vaccine, the meningococcal B vaccine, is relatively new, and it's only recently become available in the United States. And there was a lot of difficulty in developing a vaccine against this particular bacteria. So for the other four groups, I told you that making a vaccine against that capsule would lead to a very brisk immune response that would help protect the patient. But for a number of reasons, that capsule of meningococcus B does not lead to the induction of a very brisk immune response. So they had to develop a different type of vaccine against some other components of this particular bacterium.
So what you're saying is it doesn't work in the same way that A, C, W, and Y do, so they separate it out for that reason.
That's correct.
So would the guidelines be then similar? In other words, you'd have a first one at 11 and a booster later, or is it a completely different animal?
It's a little bit of a different animal. So what the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommended, and I was not part of that panel that developed these recommendations, they recommended that beginning at 10 years of age to vaccinate people with this meningococcal B vaccine if they were in particular risk groups who had an increased likelihood of being infected with meningococcus serogroup B. In addition, they did have the recommendation that for people who don't have any of those risk factors, that there should be a discussion between the patient and their physician to decide whether they should get a dose, usually between 16 and 18 years of age. And I think why they didn't make this a definitive recommendation is just because they need additional data regarding the breadth and duration of protection with this particular vaccine, so that there just wasn't as much information available for them to make the definitive recommendation.
You mentioned that it just became available in the United States, but don't they have data from the countries that have been using it longer than we have?
Yeah, the data that they have is really that it does induce an immune response. So you do develop some antibodies against some of the components of the bacterium that cause disease. But it's really very unclear whether it's going to decrease the likelihood of getting the disease. And just to give you an example, you know, in the United States, the last time the Centers for Disease Control did a surveillance study where they looked at cases of bacterial meningitis, and this was about 10 years ago, there were only about 4,000 cases of bacterial meningitis annually in the United States. And of those 4,000 cases, probably about 13 to 14% were meningococcus of all the different groups. So maybe you're talking about anywhere from 550 to 600 cases. So this is not a common disease. And really, with such a low prevalence, it's really hard to determine when you introduce a new vaccine exactly how effective it's going to be.
So one last follow-up question. Are there side effects from the vaccine? Is there a downside to getting it just to cover yourself or your children and have peace of mind?
So I do not think there's a downside. So particularly for the meningococcal B vaccine, things like pain at the injection site, some soreness or redness, some nausea or diarrhea has been reported, and some muscle or joint aches. These generally don't last longer than 3 to 7 days. Certainly, you would not give it to someone who has had a previous allergic reaction to the vaccine, but I think that it is a safe vaccine, and I think it is important that patients and their families do have the conversation with their physicians about receiving the vaccine.
Dr. Alan Tunkel is Associate Dean for Medical Education at the Warren Alpert Medical School of Brown University. He's widely acknowledged as an international expert in bacterial meningitis and other central nervous system infections. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your expertise with our listeners.
Thank you as well.